Tonight on Arena, John Connolly on his new Charlie Parker mystery, The Children of Eve, and a new Conor McPherson play opens in London's Old Vic. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And good to be back with you on this very fine Monday evening. A private detective who straddles the worlds of crime and the supernatural. John Connolly's Charlie Parker is one of the most iconic characters in contemporary crime fiction. The Children of Eve is the 24th Charlie Parker novel. Kay Sheehy met up with John Connolly and asked him about Parker's development as a character and how he is maturing.
I suppose I let him grow older, which was a good decision to make. I remember I used to love reading Robert B. Parker when I was younger. He was one of the first American crime novelists that I liked. But he kept his Detective Spencer kind of around his 40s or 50s all the time. And he'd been writing novels for about half a century, I think, by the time he died. And one of the later novels has an exchange where Spencer is talking to his girlfriend, Susan, about whether they should have a baby. And I remember thinking, but you served in Korea and you were going out with her. Just get another dog by this stage. You know, your seed is going to fall on barren soil. So to let Parker get older meant that his concerns changed and the nature of the novels changed.
Can we ask what age he is?
He's about 2 years older than I am, so he's probably in his late 50s now. And when I began writing him, I was in my mid-20s, and I'm now a grandfather. So it's been quite a long time. I can remember when I was described as the wunderkind of crime fiction, and I reckon that bus is not going to come around again. So what's been lovely about letting him grow older is that his concerns have become my concerns. You know, I've moved from a stage of worrying about myself to worrying about my children and now presumably worrying about grandchildren. And all of those things are reflected in the Parker novels.
And do you think that's what sustained your interest in him?
Oh, yeah. I would just become disengaged from him, I think. And he's become a way of looking at the world. The writer Ross MacDonald, who was another big influence on me, once said that it's sometimes you can hit the target by not aiming directly at it. And so I get to look at the world and look at the things that concern me through Parker's eyes. And so I get to refract experience, my experience as much as anybody else's. So, yeah, I think that's probably what's kept me interested.
Well, we'll talk about how he's maturing and changing maybe as we go a little into the plot. So, first of all, the title of the novel, The Children of Eve, it's intriguing. Where does it come from and where did you get an interest in it?
Well, it comes from that Catholic prayer that I learned when I was an altar boy, to thee do we cry, poor banished children of Eve. And the book, I suppose, concerns the hunt for four children who seem to have been abducted from Mexico and they were the children of a crime lord. But as far as anyone can find out or discover, his children seem to be alive and well in Mexico. So the book revolves around what are the children of Eve? Who or what are they? Because he has sent people to get them back. And it came about actually from writers are very magpie-ish and we're always looking for shiny things to store away. And many years ago, on my first book tour in Latin America, I decided to go traveling. And I booked a rental car and I probably got something like the Lonely Planet Guide, which was never to be trusted when it said things like, you know, the road is okay, but it's a little rough. What that meant was that there really wasn't a road. But I had booked a little rental car and thought I will take the scenic route because they'd advised it. And I end up in landscape. It was just pitch darkness and on a road that really wasn't a road. They just apparently sewn it with sharp stones. And I looked at it and I could see light. And I realised the back wheel had come off my car and there were just sparks flying up into the night air and my car was about to go on fire. And I pulled over to the side of the road in the middle of nowhere and thought, I'm marooned here and I don't even speak very good Spanish. And out of the gloom, a car appeared. And four or five Argentinian policemen tumbled out of this car. Now, there was a time when had four or five Argentinian policemen tumbled out of a car in the dead of night, you would have thought your situation was not about to improve dramatically. But Lord, God bless them. They put the wheel back on the car and disappeared off into the night. And I got to where I was going, but it kind of soured me on it. It was a place called Cafayete. And instead I went travelling further north and ended up discovering something that then became the seed of the Children of Eve, and I stored it away. And the thing is, I can't really talk about it because then it will reveal the nature of it. But it is what writers do. We will go looking for things. I remember when I was a student, long before I considered becoming a novelist, going to the Czech Republic, or what was then still Czechoslovakia, not long after the end of communism, and going to Sedlec, which is this extraordinary church decorated with bones, where, you know, it's the chandeliers, the altar, all are made out of human remains. And I remember just storing that away and thinking...
That was a Charlie Parker.
Yeah,
novel.
It's become the Black Angel, but, you know, that would have been a good decade or so before I wrote the book. So I think writers are quite good at that, at picking up on things and thinking, actually, that's really, really interesting. And I just hope nobody else uses it before I get a chance to.
Now, as you say, there are sinister forces coming up north from Mexico, and they're coming up to Maine, which is the home place of Charlie Parker. And we meet him first when he's at an art gallery because he knows the artist, and he is a bit concerned for her. Can you bring us into the nuts and bolts of that element of the story?
Yeah, he is. It comes back to the question you asked earlier. Because he has grown older, he has a daughter now who is approaching, probably in her late teens. He sees this young woman who's clearly not at ease in these surroundings. The artist is a woman named Zeta Naidu, who's had a difficult upbringing. And his natural response is to be concerned for her, is to turn to her. And I think it's something that's fundamental to the crime genre for me, certainly the Private Eye novel. I've never wanted to write police procedurals. They never really interested me because police procedurals are about the law and are not really terribly concerned with justice. Justice may be a byproduct, but they're about the law and a sense of order. And I think the Private Eye novel has always been about somebody intervening because morally or empathically it was the right thing to do. And that's very much Parker's response. He is in that mode of private investigators because he ends up working for Zeta Naidu, and even when she fires him, he continues to work on her behalf. And that's one of those conventions that appears in the genre. You know, most private eyes would go broke, you know, because they never cash the check and they never take the money because money is not the primary impetus for intervening. And so that has always interested me about Parker as well. He's somebody who is not able to turn away from someone who is in trouble.
Now, Jennifer Parker was the daughter of Charlie Parker, and we met her first in Every Dead Thing, which was your first Charlie Parker book, and her mother, Susan. And she plays a very prominent role in The Children of Eve. Can you recall Jennifer and Susan for us and then tell us
what's
where
odd,
she
I suppose, about the role she plays is that she's been dead for 20 years. It's one of the elements that I think is the Marmite element in my book for some people. That interest in the numinous, that interest in the supernatural, which are not generally, or for a long time were not generally considered appropriate for crime novels. The crime novel comes out of a very rationalist tradition, particularly the detective novel. And that rationalist tradition never really interested me. I had grown up reading supernatural fiction and crime fiction. And I think being Irish, we've always had an Irish artists have always been fascinated, I think, and maybe because we during the late 18th and early 19th centuries, we were the people who kept the Gothic alive. And the Gothic mutates in some ways into the crime novel. It becomes one of the genesis points of the crime novel. And you can see it kind of separating. You get the crime novel and then you get the supernatural novel. And they went off in different directions. And my instinct was kind of to bring them back together again. And so this child is still in the world, or straddling worlds. And one of the key points of the series and what it's building up to is essentially Parker's nature. What is Parker? What is he? Because his daughter seems to feel that he is something that's not entirely human, that he is here for a reason that even he's not certain about. And I think that's the revelation the books have been building to. And it's why the other challenge that I wanted to present myself, I realized, was that most writers just die. We die. We're not proper clogs. And the series is left hanging, or if the publishers have invested enough money and they're convinced people will buy it, someone else will step in and their name will be put in very small letters at the bottom. That goes back to Virginia Andrews. I remember Virginia Andrews died, after one and a half or two novels, maybe even just the first novel. And I think there are people still reading Virginia Andrews now who have no idea that Virginia Andrews died a long time ago. Very few writers end their series. The one I can think of most recently is probably Colin Dexter with Morris. And I remember Colin just didn't want to write anymore. He wanted to do crosswords in the pub and drink glasses of wine. And God bless him, why wouldn't he want to do that? Because, A, for a lot of us, you may look upon your character as a cash cow. Your publishers may look upon the character as a cash cow. And they may not want to see the end of it. And also, you risk antagonizing readers. We don't read mystery novels for the plots. The plots don't really change very much. There's a crime, there's an investigation, there's a solution. We return to serious novels for the characters, for the pleasure of spending time with them. And if you're following a series, I talked earlier about the Spencer novels, you could spend 50 years reading about the same characters. And the more interesting writers do allow their characters to age. So not only are you spending time with them, you witness their children go older. And so in a series that works in that way, each novel becomes a chapter in a larger story, in a larger book. But that book very rarely has an ending. And so some years ago, I thought, no, the Parker novels will come to a close. And there is a sense in The Children of Eve, that people can see that the novels are approaching a solution or a resolution.
So where is the dead Jennifer Parker? How do you describe that space that she occupies? Because it is very much
a liminal space, that this is a child who sits by the edge of water watching the dead go by, essentially, and losing themselves. And I think she fears that if she were to go with them, she would lose herself too. And she does not want to. She wants to wait for her father. And I think there's something quite beautiful about that image of a child waiting for a father. And also a father who has the kind of consolation of knowing that he will see his child again. As a parent, your great fear is losing your child. It's nothing more appalling. And I think one of the reasons why Parker, as the books have gone on, has become perhaps a more easeful character, or a character more at ease with himself, is the fact that he has that peace and that consolation, that sense that he will be reunited with this child. But this child knows things about him that he himself doesn't know.
Yes, because there are conversations, even if they're not matched a lot of the time, between the dead daughter and Parker. She fears she's losing him, but at another time he is talking to her.
Yeah.
So there's that beautiful relationship.
Because he had another relationship after his wife and child died, and he had another daughter. And there is an envy there that this child, it's explored in the book, where the Jennifer sees Sam, who was her half-sister, experiencing all the things she never lived to do. These very modest little things, you know, that you say, learning to drive, you know, fishing, getting to know her grandfather. And this child feeling that my father is forgetting me because he can pour all of himself into this other child, this child who's present and who is developing in a way that I never got to. So there is there's a tension there in this child.
And do you think that Parker is going into the supernatural, or maybe has there always been elements?
Oh, I think there's always been an element there, but it had to be done very gradually. Like I said at the beginning, it was one of those, it's quite divisive. And it was one of those areas for a long time that mystery writers, crime writers generally resisted going into. And so I had to lead people quite gently along that path. Because there's still people who say, I don't want to read anything that has any notion, element of the supernatural in it. I don't like that. And so from the very early novels, just kind of very gently glance against it. And the books can be read as potentially either supernatural novels or the viewpoint of a man who's breaking down, you know, who's so overcome by grief that the boundary between reality and unreality has begun to fall apart for him. And gradually, as the reader was like, readers came, continued with the series, by about the fourth or fifth novel, I thought, okay, we can do a little bit more. Let's see, if we've gone this far, how much further can we take it? And the books have an internal logic to them. They don't take huge leaps. They move quite carefully, and they're quite considered, I think, in the way that they've been planned, because I knew for quite a long time ago where I was going with them and how I wanted to end them. And so that gives you a sense of momentum, I think, in the writing of them.
And then how important is the story, the Children of Eve story, when you have this central, longer story of Charlie Parker that you're trying to tell?
I'm not, having said all those things, I'm not a planner. I've never been able to play chess. I can't, that's not how my mind works. And so usually what will happen is I will have an idea for a book. Like I said, it came out, part of it was this idea that I'd stored away from that trip to Argentina many, many years ago. And that becomes the most important thing, the book that's in hand, or the idea that's in hand. And then in the process of writing, it meshes with what I've done before. I've been doing it for so long now that actually there's something that's almost unthinking about it. It comes quite naturally. But it comes quite naturally over 2 or 3 years. You know, the books are on that kind of cycle that they will be, I'll be thinking about it for a year, I'll sit down to write it, and it will be 2 years before it makes it to a shelf. So there is a lot of time to consider how it's going to fit into it. And I rewrite constantly. So gradually it begins to mesh. But I'm working on a book at the moment that won't be published until 2027 or 2028, and it hasn't reached that stage yet. But I know that this time next year, it will. I'll have found the places where those connections occur.
Now, you were talking about there the story about the church with the bones, and then you were, there's always a lot of morbid things going on in your books. There's always a lot of violence. Charlie would have in the past been quite central. He was well able to kill people. But it seems as though he's taking a bit of a step back in terms of his bloodlust. Would that be fair to say?
The books are certainly much less violent than they were when I was a younger man. You're always trying to push the boundaries. And writing violence is not an exact science. And it becomes tied up with emotion. I remember interviewing George Pelicanos, who subsequently ended up writing for The Wire. And George saying that is, he felt his heart beat, you know, faster when he was writing those scenes rather than ones, scenes of landscape or people going and doing their shopping. There is something quite visceral about writing them. But also, it's the fact that if you're a man in your late 50s, there's a limit to what you can do. You know, I'd love to still be able to run around a football pitch, but I suspect I might last 5 minutes and then somebody would have to give me water and oxygen. And Parker's kind of that same. He is aware, as Clint Eastwood said, a man has to be aware of his limitations. And so is Parker. And that has changed the nature of the novels too. But also that he has become a gentler man, that he is more empathic. And that has influenced the tone of the novels, I think.
Yes, but you still love your set pieces. I mean, that wonderful set piece down in Mexico where Seeley comes after the antique dealer, which is the setup piece.
You know? But that's it's funny when writers are sorry, why do you write? And sometimes we can come up with all kinds of very interesting explanations that we want to write in crime fiction because we're exploring notions of justice and empathy and compassion, and all of those things that may be true. But the very least you can ask for from a book is that if you were getting on your flight to Torremolinos or wherever it might be on your Watney's Red Barrel holiday, that the book passes that time pleasantly. Because we put a lot of weight sometimes on reading. You know, I'm very judgy about people's houses. If I go into a house and it doesn't have any books in it, I'm thinking, oh, you're not really my kind of person. Or if I'm with someone at a party and they say they don't read, I'm going to get up and go and talk to somebody else. But actually, you know, reading is, at one level, is a leisure pursuit. You need to have a little bit of time, you know, you need to have, you can't be working down a mine and be exhausted. And so there's an element of entertaining the reader to what I do. I want the reader to enjoy the experience of the book. I want them to feel that they didn't waste their time with it. That's the very least that I owe the reader. And so the idea that somebody will keep turning the pages is, that's the base level for me. Everything else after that is gravy.
Now you're going on a tour.
Mm-hmm. I'm mostly doing libraries and bookstores where we're not charging.
This is a choice of yours,
yeah,
isn't it?
And I've turned down a lot of festivals. I've become increasingly uncomfortable. I want to be very careful here that I'm not being too critical. It's a funding issue. I'm uncomfortable with people being charged 15 or 20 euro to go to a literary event. Now, I understand why. Because actually, nobody running a literary festival is making any money. And thankfully, the Arts Council has got to a point where it's encouraged people to pay writers for their participation, because for a lot of times they weren't paid. And I think that's really, really important. But when we talk about access to the arts, sometimes we talk about it in terms of creators only. How can we allow people to become musicians, to become artists, to become writers? But you need an audience. And if you're charging 15 and 20 euro a ticket, you're essentially creating a middle class audience. It has to be comfortable, well-heeled people who can afford to pay these fees. And I had this discussion with somebody who's involved with funding in Ireland for the arts, and his response was, well, only middle-class people go to these things anyway. And so you end up with, at the very least, a chicken and an egg question,
yes.
Or at the very worst, you have a self-fulfilling prophecy. The gold standard is Australia, where festivals in Australia, the government takes the view that access to the arts is one of the things you pay taxes for. And that's not just having museums and galleries free. It's access to musical events and access to literary events. So the writer gets paid, and these events, for the most part, are free. You just have to book a ticket. A lot of the European countries do the same thing. Spain does it, but doesn't pay writers. Now, that doesn't work either, because obviously for a lot of writers, that's become an important income stream. There are writers who earn more from festival appearances than they do from the money that they receive from publishing. So the answer really is that we need to fund festivals a little bit better so that ticket prices can come down and be made more accessible. And I get there are people out there going, well, we're trying to build houses. And I get that. But there's a difference between subsisting and living. And you may as well say, well, why do we need parks? And why would you put a painting on the wall of your house? And why would you have flower beds? Access to art, access to music, access to culture, one of these things that actually makes our lives a little bit better if you choose to do those things. And so the only thing I can do is to say, well, look, the events I'm going to do are going to be events that people don't have to pay to enter.
The always interesting John Connolly there speaking to Kay Sheehy. John's new book, The Children of Eve, is published by Hodder and Stoughton and is out this very day. The Brightening Air is a new Conor McPherson play that opened last week at the Old Vic Theatre in London. The play is set in rural Sligo in 1981. It's the story of two siblings, Stephen and Billy, played by Brian Gleeson and Rosie Sheehy, who struggle to get by in their crumbling family home. Their life is disrupted when their older brother Dermot, played by Chris O'Dowd, and their uncle Pierre, played by Sean McGinley, pay a visit. Eimear McBride has been to see The Brightening Air and joins me on the line now. Let's start with where the play starts, which is this brother and sister, these siblings in Sligo in 1981. What kind of household do we find ourselves in, Eimear, with Stephen, played by Brian Gleeson, and Billy, played by Rosie Sheehy?
Well, I think it's a traditional crumbling, falling down farmhouse that has seen better days. And these two have been left there. Stephen is the older brother, and he's been left in charge of Rosie, who, although it's never said because it wouldn't have been said at the time, but it's clear, is autistic, and he's kind of left to be responsible for her. And there's no money. There's some scrawny cows that need milking, and a very selfish older brother who soon makes an appearance and has designs on the future of the house for himself.
It doesn't sound like poor old Stephen and Billy are in the best of situations. What about the dynamic between the two of them, given that kind of caring role in some ways that Stephen, the older brother, has, and that neurodiversity that is part of Rosie's character, or of Billy's character, I beg your pardon?
Well, you know, I think it's a tense relationship. It's not one without love and care, but also, you know, he's not really equipped to help her deal with her problems, and they don't really understand what they are in the first place. And she's very talkative, very obsessive, very prone to wandering into the town and getting knocked down by various vehicles and being left with different, you know, injuries that she's won't go to the hospital to have fixed, and that he doesn't really know how to deal with. So there's a sort of air of desperation that surrounds them.
It's a tense relationship and an air of desperation. It's your average Irish family in some ways, perhaps. into this, you're saying, and quite quickly into this comes that older brother Dermot, played by Chris O'Dowd, with designs, is how you put it, Eimear, on what might happen to the family home, and albeit run down, but the land around it as well. What does that disrupt things enormously, or what does that bring into the theatrical space for us?
Well, you know, so the one bright light in Stephen and Billy's life is Lydia, Dermot's wife, who seems to come in and out a lot and do lots and bits and pieces for them. But Dermot has fallen in in love with a much younger girl and is actively pursuing her and on the cusp of leaving Lydia for her, and arrives to kind of make an announcement about the future of the house with this young girl in tow, much to everyone's horror and his, you know, sort of total lack of sensitivity.
So he comes with the wife that Stephen and Billy, the brother and sister-in-law, they quite like her. They're quite fond of her. And she dotes on the Dermot character, I believe, the Chris O'Dowd character. But he brings along Aisling Cairns, is it, who plays the character of Freya. We have a further complication into all of this. There's an older uncle, a former priest, Father Pierre, played by Sean McGinley, and his housekeeper, Dervla Crotty. Are they there from the outset, or what's their situation?
Well, the setup at the beginning is they're coming to visit, so they're preparing a little party for them, and he's quite blind, and he has been forcibly retired from the church, which, you know, as you can imagine, 1981 took some doing on his part, and so he and his long suffering housekeeper, played by Dervla Crotty, arrive at this house, and a little do Stephen and Billy know that he is also in on Dermot's scheme to reclaim the house.
Yeah, so there's definitely something afoot. And I know there's another character, Brendan, played by Aveen Fitzgerald Doherty, a kind of a local lad who's involved in certain aspects of the whole setup.
That's
as
right.
Well, this idea of the crumbling house, you know, the family coming back, an uncle or an older brother coming back to kind of look at things, and an uncle as it is in there as well, shades at very least of Chekhov and Uncle Vanya.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have these characters who are trapped by financial circumstance in sort of terrible situations. And they are, by their nature, people who can see further, who can see beyond the society they live in and the roles that are expected of them to fulfill, but are powerless in order to kind of better their lot in life. And that aspect certainly does feel very heavily influenced by Chekhov.
Chekhov, of course, will give you both the tragedy and the comedy, and you might at times have difficulty spotting which is which in some ways, the way he handles it. What kind of atmosphere in that respect does Conor McPherson give us as both writer and director here?
Yes, no, there's plenty of comedy here, and lots of sort of roughhousing between the brothers, and, you know, people strangling each other and people slagging each other off. And there is, you know, a very playful element to it too. And Billy is quite the wicked wit when she wants to be. But then there is also another thread that's brought through, which is a sort of magical thread, which ties into the title of the play, The Brightening Air, which comes from Yeats's Song of Wandering Angus. And sort of this is about the idea of the moment when dreams become reality. And for Lydia, for instance, Dermot's wife, she's obsessed with trying to get her husband back and trying to persuade her brother-in-law to go up the hill to find the magic well where there will be water that, if she can get him, Dermot, to drink it, will make him fall back in love with her. And that is, you know, considerably less Chekhovian device,
yeah.
I would say.
But very typically MacPhersonian, if that particular adjective exists. I was listening earlier on when John Connolly was speaking with Kay Sheehy about his current novel, and he talks about the supernatural, or he talked about the supernatural in his Charlie Parker mysteries, and he said it's a kind of a Marmite element within my books, was how he put it. What about that within, and it's there in lots of Conor McPherson plays, this sense of something outside of the very realistic settings often that we get. I'm thinking particularly of The Weir, set in a pub, but there's a kind of a supernatural element within it all as well. Is it a Marmite element to you, or does it work for you?
For me, very much the Marmite element. I feel as though that kind of stringing that sort of thread through an otherwise realistic narrative only works if the realistic narrative in itself really works. And I think there are kind of, there's so many things that he's put into this play that it's quite hard to work out what the play is supposed to be about, really, until the very end of it. And I think the kind of the supernatural element is a distraction and a thread that doesn't necessarily ring true with the, you know, with the much more sort of mundane greediness of the Dermot character, the selfishness of Father Pierre, or the Chekhovian lostness of a lot of the other characters.
Yeah, and I'm looking at a cast list of nine in total, or certainly eight or nine of a cast. So are there too many things going on? I mean, as you described it, and that kind of greed for the family plot, that sounds as if it has a very strong narrative drive. Are there things that pull it away from that strong narrative drive?
I think there are a lot of things that he starts to investigate. So, for instance, the character played by Dervla Crotty, Elizabeth, who is the long-suffering housekeeper.
Of the Sean McGinley character, of the Father Pierre, the former priest.
Of the Father Pierre character, yeah. So she... We sort of wake up in the morning and she's spent the night with Stephen, and there's this very poignant, beautiful conversation between these two, you know, deeply lonely people who evidently have this relationship where every few years something happens between them, but nothing is enough to ignite it further or to draw them out of their loneliness. And it's a very beautifully written and beautifully performed scene. And then that's the end of it. You never hear of it again. There's no return to that thread, and you sort of long for it. And the, you know, the performances are so beautiful. You want to know more about what happened to these people, but instead we're kind of rushed through into the next bit where, you know, the priest is discussing having his, you know, loss of faith and visions of the Virgin Mary, and you know, and you're just kind of pushed through another cycle of story that doesn't really seem to connect to what's happened before, and you wait for it to connect by the end, and I don't feel that it really does.
And I mean, what a cast that Conor McPherson has here. You know, you've mentioned some of them there: Brian Gleeson, Rosie Sheehy playing Brian Gleeson as the brother, Rosie Sheehy playing the sister. She's been Olivia nominated this year, I believe. Then Chris O'Dowd, Hannah Morrish as the long suffering wife, Aisling Cairn, Sean McGinley, Dervla Crotty, and this young newcomer, Aveen Fitzgerald Doherty. It is quite the cast. Did any performance or set of performances stand out for you? You've mentioned Brian Gleeson and Dervla Crotty in that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think the absolute standout performance is Rosie Sheehy. I mean, it is, she at the end does elevate it into a true Chekhovian tragedy. She has this incredibly beautiful, painful monologue at the end when it seems that Stephen is finally going to leave. And a conversation about love and about loneliness, about what the future can be or should be, and yet what it will be. And, you know, it's... you could feel the whole audience. You know, there was a lot of people in there who arrived and wanted to laugh and kept trying to laugh even when it wasn't funny anymore. And even they shut up and tensed at her performance. I thought she was really quite astonishing, actually.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk. There's a lot of talk about her. And as I say, Olivier nominated this year for another production that she was involved in. Overall, then, I mean, strong cast in terms of what you saw on this. Oh, just one other question I wanted to ask about Conor McPherson. Obviously, Girl from the North Country and kind of attachment to David Bowie spring to mind. Mm-hmm. Does music play a role in this play?
No, not really. I mean, there's a bit of piano playing, but I think what's more important is Ray Smith's design and costume design of, you know, recreating the early 1980s in Ireland. I mean, and Chris O'Dowd does have an astonishing jumper that I'm pretty sure both of my elder brothers owned a copy of back in 1981.
Yes.
So I was impressed to see that on stage.
I was frighteningly familiar with the jumper that he was wearing from the photographs that I saw. Is it worth, I can see that you have certain caveats in what you're saying. I can hear that, Emer. Is it worth seeing for all of that?
I think it's worth seeing. I think it's worth seeing for some of the performances. I think if it wasn't Conor McPherson writing and directing, I'm not sure it would have got to the production stage without another draft. And but go along for sure.
Yeah, but despite that, you still think that there's enough there to merit going to see it.
Yes, I think so. But I also hope that, you know, maybe in a few years' time he'll revisit it and do a few revisions.
All right, that's Eamonn McBride talking to us about Conor McPherson's new play, The Brightening Air. It is at the Old Vic in London. And if you are travelling that direction, it is there until Saturday, June the 14th. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And indeed, you can watch us right now on rte.ie/arena. Fela Oriel, or the Fiddler of Oriel Festival, is back and happening in Monaghan Town this bank holiday weekend. Fela Oriel is a fiddle player's dream. There are gigs, there are sessions and a competition to find the best fiddlers of Oriel, both young and old. Headlining the event are the High Octane Bow Brothers. The group comprises six distinguished musicians: Cathal Hayden, Stephen Hayden, Niall Murphy, Jim Higgins, Shimmy O'Dowd and Brian McGrath. And I'd say sometimes it grows beyond that six somehow or other as well, each of whom has made a significant contribution to the world of music, but as solo, not also both as solo performers and as part of iconic bands. Here with me in studio are three members of the band: Cathal Hayden, his brother Stephen, and Niall Murphy. They're going to begin with a composition of Cathal's, composed originally for banjo, I do believe, but here being performed on three fiddles. This is Gorth of Vale Rock. Thank you. Yes, the Gort of Ill Rock played for us there by three of the members of the Bow Brothers, that being Stephen Ann Cahill Hayden and Niall Murphy, the third member making up that group for us. And how much energy was there? It sounded like more than three fiddles at times that night to me, which is a compliment, I have to say. Cahill, a composition of yours, Gort of Ill Rock?
Yeah, that's a good few years ago now. And I was in a studio up in outside Port Lannoy, and I had the first part and the third part, and I had a kind of an idea about the middle part. But a great musician and a great friend and who runs that studio up there, a great musician called Sean O'Graham. So it's really only two thirds mine.
You're giving Sean O'Graham the bit of credit.
Yeah, Sean O'Graham came up with the second bit there. So
and. You're from Rock in County Tyrone. This is called Gort of Ill Rock, but there are loads of meanings to the word rock, but there's a sense of a little bit more than the traditional thing. I was watching Niall at one point there, this with this kind of pizzicato, almost like the rhythm section of a band in underneath it. There's a sense of you kind of mixing rock and trad in some ways.
I think that was partly the idea when I was thinking what to call it. Mm. But Gort of Ill is where my father's family came from. That's the townland. Sort of between Pomroy and that little village, The Rock. And my mother came from the village of The Rock.
Right.
So I suppose that's where the name came from. But The Rock, that rocky feel that we it's all about that too.
It's part of what you were talking about too. And we're talking about Oriel, and when you talk about Tyrone, I mean, Oriel is kind of South Ulster with a wee bit of Louth and Cavan thrown in, a bit of Leitrim probably thrown in for good measure.
It's 30 miles down the road.
Yeah, so there's it's the kind of the borderlands.
It is, of course,
what we're talking about when we talk about Oriel. Big family tradition in your house, Stephen. I mean, Cahill giving us a sense of it there. Yeah. Was it inevitable that music was going to be certainly the two of you headed into?
It was coming from both sides. You know, Mummy played the piano and Daddy played the fiddle and the banjo, and sort of surrounded with it from the start. You know, there was always music played in the house, and couldn't be avoided.
Couldn't be avoided for sure. And Bow Brothers, obviously, a reference there to the fiddle of the bow. So we have three here today, but it's normally a six piece, is it?
It is, yeah. We have the great Shamie O'Dowd on guitar from Sligo, and a founder member of a band that I'm more associated with called Four Men and a Dog. Brian McGrath on piano and Jim Higgins on percussion. From Galway.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned Four Men and a Dog there. You're also part of the Martin O'Connor trio.
Yes, that's true.
You worked with Christy Moore quite a lot.
Well, I had worked with Christy up until the COVID time, when COVID hit us. So I was working with Christy for 3 or 4 years before that, you know, so that enjoyable time, I must say. A great time for me, and I really enjoyed working with Christine.
And then Niall, so you had to come into the midst of the Hayden family and all of that tradition.
Kind of the brother from another mother kind of a thing. So, kind of just drafted in for the album, and what started off as maybe two or three tracks just snowballed into a bit more, and here we are. It's great to be bought.
Well, listen, you're one of the judges for Fela Oriel, and I'll speak to you specifically about that. But I do want to listen to the second piece, and I want to have time to listen to all of it. Okay. So maybe I'll get Stephen and Niall to make their way back over. Will you tell us about this piece, Cahill, as they are making their way to the performances?
It's the first tune is called The Queen of the May. It's a well-known jig. And it's part of one set that we play on an album that we brought out a good few years ago called The Bow Brothers. And the second piece, we set it up for a reel, and it's called The New Policeman.
The New Policeman. And I love the little link in between the two pieces. Like I was listening to you before we came to air this evening. So let's have a listen to those two pieces, The Queen of the May and I forget what kind of policeman he was, but let's listen to him anyway. Thank you. There we go, Niall Murphy and Stephen and Cathal Hayden there with who are the Bow Brothers collectively. And I just say, Niall is one of the adjudicators for the competition, the Féile Óireall, and he's a former junior and senior winner. But the great fiddlers of the great elders of fiddlers will also fiddling rather will be part of the upcoming Féile Óireall. Some great players within all of that as well. Lots of gigs to be going to, and of course you can go and hear the Bow Brothers headlining on what night is that?
Sunday.
On Sunday evening, Cathal, Stephen and Niall and the rest of the other three fellas will be in there as well. Féile Óireall in Monaghan Town Saturday. For more information on Féile Óireall concerts, sessions and all of the competitions, go to féileóireall.com. And that is all we have time for on this Monday evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Niall McMonigal was on sound this evening. Research was by Paula Shields and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the 8 o'clock. No, John Creedon will not be with you. Ray Cudahy will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.